Dr. Roman Frigg is Director of the Centre for Philosophy of Natural and Social Science at the London School of Economics, one of the world's distinguished academic research centres for philosophy of science. He is also Associate Professor of Philosophy in the Department of Philosophy, Logic and Scientific Method, again at the London School of Economics and the once academic home of both Karl Popper and Imre Lakatos. He holds a PhD in philosophy from the University of London and a master's degree in both theoretical physics and philosophy from the University of Basel in Switzerland. Roman, when talking about realism in both philosophy and science, you have initially chosen the very recent and well-known example from particle physics of that of the Higgs boson. So by using contemporary theories in particle physics, please go ahead and start on how we can think about realism and anti-realism when applied initially to the Higgs boson.
A so-called standard model of particle physics has it that there is a really important small particle called the Higgs boson. Physicists have been hunting that particle for a long time, and a short while ago, finally, the news broke that the particle had been found in Geneva, in CERN, and this has been awarded with a Nobel Prize. Now, the particle is described as having a certain mass, a certain lifetime, and have a certain size. The philosophical question is, well, does the Higgs boson really exist? Now, if you say yes, then you're very broadly a scientific realist. And if you say no, then you're very broadly a scientific anti-realist. Now, why is this an interesting question? So if I ask you whether you're a realist about cats and dogs, you can just go out in the street, check things you see around you, and with your naked eyes, you can see, after some looking around, things that you would recognize as cats or dogs. And then you would say, yep, I found cats and dogs, therefore cats and dogs do exist. Now, you can't do the same thing with a small particle like the Higgs boson, which you can't simply see with your naked eyes. In fact, very, very complicated experimental procedures are needed to find the Higgs boson. And what the machinery in CERN produces are a huge amount of data that are then subjected to various data cleansing and analyzing procedures. And the result of a very complicated process is the discovery that the Higgs boson actually does exist, or so the story goes. So the question really is, do you think that these procedures are truth conducive? Do they tell us what's going on out there, or are they not? For those who have followed the media coverage about the Higgs boson, this may seem to be a somewhat strange question. You have all those famous and very credible scientists saying that this particle really is there. How could one question that such a particle actually is there? Well, that's a good question, and you will hear more about this later in this interview. But before I say a bit more about what motivates the anti-realist position, I want to say in a bit more detail what scientific realism actually means. Because when we try to pin down that position, we see that there is more to it than just saying something is there. Scientific realism can be broken down into three theses. The first thesis could be summarized under the slogan, reality is prior to thought. And the claim here really is that the world is out there, it's not dependent on human minds, and it actually has a structure. So it makes sense to say the world just is what it is, and the structure of the world is not in any way dependent on creatures looking at it or studying it. The second thesis is what one could call semantic realism. And semantic realism just means that one should take scientific theories at face value. And that is, scientific theories have to be understood as giving us a literal description of their subject matter, and they can be true or false. So they are not metaphorical, they're not in any way non-literal. If a theory says the Higgs boson exists, well, then the Higgs boson exists. There is nothing more to it. And the third component of realism is what one could call epistemic optimism. But epistemic optimism just says that mature and predictively successful scientific theories are at least approximately true. So we're not caught in some sort of skeptical bubble where we have nice theories, but we can never know whether they actually fit reality. So epistemic optimism says that if we have a good, mature, predictively successful theory, we have good reason to believe that the theory is at least approximately true. So now with these three premises, or these three components of realism in place, we can also classify anti-realism. Depending which of these you deny, you get different brands of anti-realism.
Okay, thanks for that, Roman. Just to contextualize those three main principles of realism for those that aren't necessarily familiar with the complex aspects of philosophy of science. So the first aspect would be that reality itself is independent of any prior mental or cognitive state that we have. That is, the world exists externally and independent to the conscious observer, such as ourselves, and this would go against something like the Eastern tradition, which might speculate that there is actually mind before matter. That would be the first point.
Yeah.
The second aspect of realism, that of semantic realism, would mean that theories are taken at literal face value. So when the theory says that the atom, the electron is there, or that gravity is there, it really is there. These aren't euphemisms, these aren't metaphors. This also applies to broader aspects of the laws of physics, that when they say that motion or pressure or resistance acts in this way, it really does act in this way, and this is how it operates in this way. Or else, why would you take such a risk of getting on the plane if the laws of physics say this is how the plane will operate?
Yeah, exactly.
And the third and final aspect, this of epistemic optimism, generally say that, okay, throughout history, we have postulated many theories to represent the natural phenomenon around us. Some of them have been successful, have been approximately right, but we know that we've revised theories throughout history, but that's not to say every time we do it that we dispense completely of old elements, and okay, particle physics now isn't what it was 100 years ago, but there are still elements that are generally approximately true. So we take particle physics and other theories in science to be at least approximately true.
Yep, that sounds right. Yeah, I think that sums it up very nicely.
Now, Roman, you have concisely put forward the three elementary aspects behind realism. You've also said that depending on which one of these three aspects of realism you may deny, then that has a correlative response on the kind of anti-realist position you would then pronounce. So please go ahead and list the general anti-realist positions in philosophy of science.
Yeah, exactly. So if you accept the first two and only deny the third component, then you get some sort of skepticism. So the world is there, theories can be taken literal, but you never really know whether your theories fit. So you're a skeptic, really. If you deny number two, then you get what has been called reductive empiricism. So this is the view that you shouldn't really take theories literal. So theories use all kind of theoretical language, but the theoretical language is just a crutch of thought, really. So at the end of the day, language in a theory referring to things you can't observe, they have to be paraphrased away in terms of things that you can observe. For instance, when you talk about an electron, you can't see electrons, you would have to explain that at the end of the day in terms of what you observe in a certain experimental context. And if you deny the first premise, then you get into some sort of constructivism whereby the reality is a figment of the mind or is constituted by the mind and this is not mind dependent. Okay, so we have understood now what realism and anti-realism are. Let's now see what arguments there are on either side of the divide. And there are basically three main arguments in the discussion. Obviously, there are variants and subvariants, and there's a whole cottage industry working on this. But essentially, there are three main arguments. And the first of these arguments is the so-called no miracles argument. And the intuition here is very simple. If you have a theory that makes a genuinely new prediction, something you haven't already written into the theory when you formulate it, so something that's really unexpected, really new, really something you haven't thought about before, then you go away, you make an experiment, and you actually find what the theory predicts, then that's really surprising. And it would just be a miracle if that would happen, if the theory wasn't at least approximately true. Let's illustrate that with a famous historical episode, which I have learned from my colleague John Worrell. So at the beginning of the 19th century, Fresnel was studying light, and he had a wave theory of light that predicted that in the shadow of a little disk, there should be a little bright spot. Now that sounds very counterintuitive. So you wouldn't expect to be a bright spot in a shadow. Well, someone else went to the laboratory, made the experiment, and there it was. So that really did confirm a theory, and it really paved the way to the wave theory of light. And for a long time, particle theories of light were effectively out of the window because this prediction was so counterintuitive. It has not been built into the theory when it was first formulated, and then it turned out to be correct. So that really gave the theory a huge boost. And you see sort of how this no miracles intuition is at work here. The argument is about, like, it would just be a miracle if this prediction was right, if the theory itself was completely wrong.
Okay, so the no miracles argument posits that due to the extraordinary predictive success of science, that it would be almost impossible for science not to be getting at some aspects of reality due to this phenomenal power it has in predicting outcomes measured in phenomena. And another example of this would be quantum mechanics, where the measurements in quantum mechanics are so precise, they're down to X amount of decimal points. So quantum mechanics, their mathematical predictions and their measurements are so precise that it would be a miracle for it not to be getting at an aspect of reality. This would be another way of thinking of the no miracles argument, would it not?
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure, absolutely. You have all these extremely precise measurements, sort of quantum theory predicts certain values, and you measure them, and the measurements really give you what you have predicted. So that is exactly what the no miracle argument is thriving on. The philosophical question that follows this is, well, why is the no miracle argument actually a good argument? It's very persuasive, but why should we believe it? And that gets you into the whole discussion surrounding the so-called inference to the best explanation. The inference to the best explanation has been around for a while. I mean, it goes back to Peirce, probably. It's been so-called in a paper in the 1960s. And the idea is really very, very simple. So you have a certain phenomenon to explain. You come up with all kind of explanations. Then you study these explanations. And then you look at how good they are. Then you pick which you think is the best of the explanations. And then comes the inferential step. You say, the best explanation I accept as the true explanation. You find this kind of logic at work in all kind of everyday contexts. It's often used in legal cases, in particular when forensic evidence is used, but also in simple common sense reasoning. When I pass in front of the office of my colleague Alex and I hear a keyboard rattling, well, one explanation is that Alex is in his office and he's typing away, but it could also be that he left his window open and the wind is blowing in and the wind's rattling the keyboard. Or there could be a demon in the office who's shaking the computer, etc., etc. But then I rank these explanations in terms of their plausibility. And then I think, well, the explanation that he's actually there is the most plausible one. So I infer that he's really there.
You've given us a good demonstration of the applicability of inference to the best explanation in common everyday situations. However, of course, it's worth pointing out here that from a psychological perspective and an everyday cognitive perspective, what constitutes the best explanation for a social or natural phenomenon by the individual is obviously going to be tainted by ideological and possibly religious views and or generally predisposed schemas. And we can clearly see this played out in political affairs where different ideological orientations or ascriptions to worldviews differ significantly when trying to provide the best explanation for an occurrence. But in the context of the scientific method specifically, inference to the best explanation is obviously far more detailed, concise and rigorous and is usually based off an inductive statistical method. So what constitutes the best explanation in science is born out of testing the most applicable theories, seeing where the best evidence lies and producing that from statistical methods. And that's generally how scientists come to the best explanation for a phenomenon in the scientific method.
Yeah, obviously in scientific context, it's more regimented what is an acceptable explanation. So the inference to the best explanation is really a bone of contention in philosophy. So it's plausible, it sounds nice, but not everybody agrees that this is a valid form of inference. And the first problem is the problem you were alluding to is, well, what counts as a good explanation? I mean, there is breaking point. So I can, of course, write down all kind of explanations. I can go to supernatural, crazy ideas, whatnot. Where is the boundary and how do I rank different explanations according to a goodness scale? How does that work? And many proposals have been made, such as simplicity or stringency or explanatory power, coherence, scope, unity, whatnot. But all these things remain controversial, so it's probably fair to say that there's no generally accepted view on this. And I mean, if you're an anti-realist, you're capitalizing on that. You say, look, you can't give a waterproof statement of the inference with the best explanation, therefore we shouldn't accept it. The second problem is that you can only rank explanations you actually have, but we may simply miss out on the really good explanations. So we may have come up with a host of explanations, but they are actually bad explanations all. Some are less bad than others, but on the whole, we're dealing with a bad lot. So would you then accept the hypothesis just because it is the best one within a bad lot? Well, probably not. So being better than the others doesn't mean that it's good. And so that's a second big problem for the inference with the best explanation. And also, as you can imagine, there is a dispute going on about this in the philosophy of science. Okay, the second important argument in the debate is the pessimistic meta-induction. And that also brings us back to the Higgs boson. And it lends a bit of plausibility, at least, to the question whether something like the Higgs boson exists. So the pessimistic meta-induction effectively draws attention to the history of science and says, look at the history of science. And the history of science is effectively a graveyard of discarded theories. If you look the last 200-300 years, all kind of theories have come. They have been successful for a while. People did believe in it. So they were highly respected. The authors of the theories got prizes. And yet, they turned out to be wrong at the end of the day, so they got discarded. They ended on the dustbin of history. And then that's the inductive step. The argument goes, look, why do you think the theory that are currently accepted fare any better than the theories in the past? So now we believe the standard model is right and the Higgs boson exists. But hey, 50 or 100 years from now, physics may have moved on. They think something completely different. And the Higgs boson may just as well be considered a mistake of history, just like so many other things. For instance, in the 19th century, heat was regarded as something like a liquid. It got a name, it was called caloric. And people had wave equations for this and sort of studied how that liquid spreads. But then that view got completely discarded. And we now don't think that there is anything like a liquid that spreads that is heat. Heat is particle motion. So we think today. So maybe the Higgs boson is just like the caloric. Earlier days. And sort of that's the sort of argument that an anti-realist would run. And you find these sort of problems, all kinds of sciences. You find them in physics, you find them in chemistry, you find them in biology. Just think about all the different theories of inheritance that have been around and were successful for a while. So that's effectively the strategy the anti-realist runs here. Okay, the third argument in our catalogue is the underdetermination of theory by evidence. And the basic observation here is that theory is not determined by empirical evidence. When you have a set of observations, usually there is more than one theory that is coherent with the observations. A simple example of that is curve fitting. So you make a number of measurements, say you make 5 measurements or 10 measurements of a certain quantity, say you measure the pressure and the temperature of a gas, but then you want to know what is the relation between temperature and pressure generally. Then you want to fit the continuous curve through your measurement points, and these points just don't determine which curve exactly you fit through the points. You can always fit one curve, but you can also fit another curve. So there are many curves that are compatible with the data you have. And so the argument goes, theorizing is generally just like curve fitting. You can always find an alternative theoretical explanation for the available evidence. And so that's why you shouldn't take your theory all too seriously. That's the anti-realist argument from the underdetermination of theories.
Okay, so whenever we have empirical information, there are a multitude of theories that we could use to explain the empirical observations that we're seeing. Now, most people could understand that, but then what occurs is a tipping point, because if you see throughout history where there were many competing theories trying to explain a phenomena and then one eventually wins. Now, scientists would probably like us all to understand that this is because the empirical information available supports one theory over another, and hence why that one is picked. But of course, the main proponents of underdetermination of theory by evidence would say it's not that simple. But to give a significant example from the 20th century would be the aspect of Big Bang cosmology versus steady state theory espoused by someone like Hoyle. Now, at one stage, they were both vying for explanatory status, but eventually the Big Bang theory was widely accepted as explaining the origin of the universe due to the weighing up on scales, per se, of the evidence available. So when you have multiple explanations for a phenomena observed, there then comes a point where there's so much evidence in favour of one theory that scientists run with that one as a form of explanation. What can be said about this, and how does this fit in with realism and anti-realism?
Well, I don't think there is a general answer. It really depends on what case exactly you're looking at. And also it depends where you're coming from. People are more coming from the sociological corner would say, well, it all depends on the power structure in a certain community. So it depends who happens to have the say on things. But then it's also some aspect of fruitfulness to it. So some theories are more fruitful than others. And I think this is a point that Kuhn made very strongly. So it really depends whether a paradigm holds the promise of further research questions, new results. You can actually do something with a theory. You can ask new questions. You can take your research in new directions. And that seems to be a very important aspect that scientists pay attention to when they choose their theories. And probably this was also what drove the choice between the Big Bang theory and the steady state theory. Of course, there was all the empirical evidence, but if you start thinking about the universe in the Big Bang way, there's so many exciting new questions you can ask that just seemed to be a better thing to do than holding on to steady state cosmology. So we have seen various arguments for and against realism, and I've given you sort of a rough characterization of realism before, but this characterization of realism in terms of our three conditions does not really narrow it down completely. You can still be a realist of various different kinds. And sort of I want to tell you a bit more about what kind of realisms there are on the market at the moment. One can, of course, be a full-blown realist. And that would just mean that you take the first three conditions that we had a bit earlier pretty much at face value. In particular, the second one, you do take theories at face value. And what makes you full-blown realist is that you take the whole theory at face value. You're not separating out. So you're not saying this is a good bit, this is a bad bit. You take the full theory at face value. And if the theory is predictively successful, you take this to indicate that the whole theory is at least approximately true. Now, that runs into problems, as you would imagine, with the pessimistic meta-induction, the underdetermination of theories, as we have just seen. So the main action in the debate was to give a formulation of realism that actually solves the problem of the pessimistic meta-induction. And I think the most prominent form here is structural realism. And structural realism is a form of selective realism. We're going to see further forward, take the entire theory at face value, but you draw a line between parts of the theory that you want to take seriously and parts that you don't want to take seriously. And structural realism says, look, the part you should take seriously is the structure of a theory, and you discard sort of the metaphysics behind it, as it were. And again, I'm using an example from John Worrell's work here. And this is the Maxwell-Fresnel episode. So Fresnel's theory of light that we have already mentioned before had all kind of ideas about the exact nature of light. And these ideas were discarded later on and considered wrong. However, Fresnel got the exactly right mathematical equations. So Fresnel's equations were later on integrated into Maxwell's theory of light, and they remained the same. So the idea is to say that, look, it is the structure of the theory as it is encoded in the theory's equation that survives the transition from one theory to another. And therefore, we should take these equations seriously while we can discard what people say about the nature of light. Now, of course, the question here is how typical the Fresnel-Maxwell episode is. And questions have been raised about that because it seems to be an exceptional episode, as John Worrell has pointed out himself, one should say. So typically you don't find cases where equations just get taken over one to one. Typically equations change. So in the transition from Newtonian mechanics to quantum mechanics, or from Newtonian mechanics to relativistic physics, you don't find this continuity of equations. And then the challenge for the structural realist there is to articulate a notion of the preservation of structure that makes sense of such transitions. And that turns out not to be entirely trivial. And that is also a field of research, and still people work on this problem.
Sure, that's a problem that's found by many trying to advocate structural realism. Now, this is sometimes in tension with the Thomas Kuhnian idea of paradigm shifts. That is, that when theories change from one period in history to another, it isn't just that the theories are adapting to what is being perceived as new aspects of reality and refining those theories. Literally, the concepts that underpin these theories and the paradigms that accompany them are changing, and therefore ultimately reality as we're understanding it through scientific theories is changing. So that's structural realism counterposed with some aspects of the Kuhnian paradigm shift is another area that the realist and the anti-realist have that produces contentions between the two. What are some of your ideas and thoughts on Kuhnian paradigm shift and its consequences on concepts and values not just being carried over from one theory to another or being slightly refined, but literally that they are changing and thus they have ramifications on both our ontological and epistemological views?
Yeah, a couple of things to be said. I mean, first, what you're saying is effectively that we're up against what have been called the Kuhn loss. So whenever theories change, you're not only gaining, you're also losing. You can do things with the old theory you can no longer do with the new theory. And so the challenge for the realist is to say that, yeah, okay, what we're losing is in some way not essential. Now, I'm not sure this can be done completely. Generally, the big problem is whether you can identify essential parts in a non-ad hoc way. See, the problem is that hindsight is a wonderful thing. When you look back, you can always say, oh yeah, this was essential, this wasn't essential, because you know what survived, and then it becomes sort of a tautology. So whatever survived was essential, and whatever didn't survive wasn't essential, and then the position becomes vacuous. So the challenge is to find a criterion for what's essential and what's not that is not dependent on knowing what the next scientific revolution will do. And that is really what the current debate is all about. I mean, can you do this or can you not do it? So is it possible to articulate a criterion for structural bits in a theory that you know should be a realist about, and you're confident that they will survive the next scientific revolution in the sense that they will show up in the successor theory again? And that turns out to be a very difficult question. And that's really the hard one. And you simply don't know what to be a realist about if you can't pinpoint the bits that you think that will survive the next revolution. So it's really the crucial question for the structural realist. However, in all fairness, one should say that not only the structural realist has to answer that question. I mean, this is a question for all realists. And maybe that's the opportunity to delve into the next position, which is known as entity realism. And in a sense, entity realism is the exact opposite of structural realism. So structural realism says, well, look, all that matters is the mathematical structures and what people say about the nature of things, just forget about it. While, if you're an entity realist, you say, no, what you should really take seriously is the entities that theories posit. So if you have a theory that talks about electrons, then there may be different equations for electrons and there are different ways of explaining it theoretically. There is different mathematical frameworks to describe electrons. So all that is descriptive fluff in a sense. What you should be realist about is the entity itself, as you should be a realist about that particle there, and you shouldn't take theoretical details very seriously. So if you can build, for instance, a microscope that works with electrons and you can manipulate electrons, you can spray electrons, then this is a good reason to believe that these particles are really there. But whether they are described by one equation or another equation is not really the crucial point. So it's in a sense the prescription to throw away the structure and keep the entity. That's where the position gets its name from. The main challenge for this position is, of course, to articulate what the entity is if you don't take the theoretical content into account. Because what does it mean to say, well, I'm a realist about the electron, but I don't take a theory about the electron seriously? I mean, we only know what an electron is because we have a theory of an electron. So you get into the issue of dividing up sort of the entities into properties that you think are essential and not dependent on particular theories, and ones that are not essential. And that turns out to be difficult. And in a sense, this is the mirror problem of finding the structural bits that you see. The structural realist thinks will survive the next scientific revolution.
Now, as you mentioned there, Roman, regarding entity realism being the opposite of the structural realist problem in realism versus anti-realism, and structural realism might attempt to present this argument that there is always an underlying surface to reality, that okay, we may chip away at different concepts within theories and refine theories, but ultimately we are maintaining this baseline structure of reality as we go along. And then the entity realist may just prefer to specifically concentrate on the current entities that are in contemporary scientific theories and research, and just concentrate on those, and let's just leave what might be an underlying structural reality that's continuous underneath all this. Let's just leave that to the side and focus on the entity itself that we attempting to observe, predict, and build into theories with more explanatory power, hence entity realism. The problem perhaps that is faced by both structural realism and entity realism is the fact that they both, to a certain extent, depend on theoretical ladenness. Now, the theoretical dependence of observations and the role specifically of theories with relation to realism and anti-realism is an incredibly dense subject in itself that's worthy of its own podcast, so we won't go into the specific details of that right now. But just in terms of scientific theories in general, if you can just give us a potential overview of how scientific theories relate to representation of the world and how this relates to realism and anti-realism.
Representation, most broadly construed, is the property of being about something. So a theory represents its target if the theory is about this target. So you have a theory of light, and the theory has to represent light if it is a theory of light. Or you have a matter, then that has to represent matter. There are various questions one can ask. One can, of course, ask, how does a theory do that? And then you're asking a question about semantics, and then you're getting close to philosophy of language. Like, you can ask, how does language work? How do we manage to refer to certain objects by using words? What do terms mean? What is the meaning of terms? And that's an important part of what philosophy of language tries to address. Now, whether you understand problem of scientific representation along the lines of philosophy of language depends very much on how you understand theories. And that's another long discussion, but basically there are two camps here and sort of a hybrid camp in the middle. So one camp understands theories as linguistic entities. Theories are seen as giving us a description of reality. And then the issue of scientific representation basically comes down to the issue of understanding the language of science. And then one could run this as a philosophy of language project, effectively. However, the other camp says, no, look, we shouldn't understand theories as linguistic entities. So theories are non-linguistic entities. And then already the issue is, well, what non-linguistic entity? But a common answer is that they are mathematical structures or set theoretical structures. And then the question becomes, how do such structures represent something else? And then a common answer is to say, this is something like an isomorphism going on there. So you have a structure that is isomorphic to something in the world. And then the challenge for such a view is to articulate what exactly that means. What does it mean to say that a mathematical structure is isomorphic to something in the world? And that raises all kind of interesting issues. Now, how does it relate to realism? Now, you can only be a realist if you think a theory has representational content. So that's, again, condition two, or the precondition to condition two. So remember, condition two of realism says you should take a theory at face value. This means, A, that the theory does have representational content. The theory actually represents something, be this in the language way, be this in the isomorphism way. And then the realist stance is that this should be really taken at face value, because I mean, we often speak metaphorically. We use all kind of figures of speech. We speak in an indirect way. And some anti-realists think that this is exactly what theories do. So we introduce terms like Higgs boson or electron or gene, basically to facilitate our talk, because they're sort of basically crutches of thought, but they shouldn't be taken seriously. These terms do not refer to anything, so the view goes. And the realist says, no, this is not right. So if you have a biological theory, the theory talks about genes, we should take gene talk seriously. So our term gene actually refers to something. So this, to come back to the semantic issue, means to say that the theory has representational content, and you take the representational content to be literally true and not in some figurative, metaphorical or roundabout way. So that's basically where the issue of representation comes into realism. So one could sum them up by saying that representation is a precondition for realism. If you don't have any representational content, then the realism question simply makes no sense.
Okay, great. Thanks for that summary and review, Roman. Just before I let you go, what's next for you on the agenda in terms of academic research and what areas are you currently working on and some potential areas now and in the future?
There was a long review paper on structural realism coming out just over a year ago. So if you're interested in all the details about structural realism, that's a good thing to look at. Then sort of the applied realism question, as it were, I've been studying climate modeling in more detail recently. So see what we should make of it. So if I was a good realist, I would have tried to take climate models at face value and take everything seriously that they say. Now, as you would expect, things are more complicated. So I'm going to try to articulate sort of a partial realist view of what they do. So there's several papers coming out. They can all be found on my website, by the way. That's just romanfrick.org. So I make all my papers available. Then I'm working on statistical mechanics. I think it's a fascinating theory. Also trying to be a realist as much as I can about it, but some parts have to be discarded. So this is some work on the foundation of statistical mechanics coming out. And then after sort of a little break on modeling and representation, I'm actually just getting back to it. And I'm together with a PhD student of mine, James Nguyen, I'm working on a theory of scientific representation and scientific modeling. And I hope that this will take shape over the course of this year.